But what I did today is I brought in a chart on the back. I figured the oil tax subject's going to come up. It's a new piece of work done on the sixth volume of studies that the Senate Finance Committee was interested in, mainly driven by myself. And they're getting close to their sixth volume in their summary document. And they sent this poster, and it has 156 oil basins or countries around the world dealing with hydrocarbons. And it has Alaska in it, and it's kind of nice sometimes to have data from third-party folks that aren't interested in the oil and gas discussion within Alaska to try to put Alaska in context with the rest of the world. And feel free during this discussion today just to get up and go back and look at it if you want, because it's just going to be a conversation today. You won't miss anything. You can look at that chart and listen at the same time. I'm sure that's not a problem for anybody in here. But I thought it'd be interesting because some people have made comments around the state that are just so far off the mark dealing with our oil and gas basins that some clarity is definitely needed. But with that, I'd like to just go ahead and start down the questions. I guess, ready to go, and I'll let you go ahead and just state the question, and then I'll follow through.
That sounds good. So the first question that we have for you today is, what are your top three legislative priorities?
Number one is getting elected. I would say that would be number one. And then it comes down to, after that, an organization, try to get into a good position within the legislative arena, particularly the Senate, and then the relationship with the House, so you've got more influence than the average senator. Mainly, you know, it's nice to be in leadership. And then from there, it's all going to be focused on energy, and there'll be different energy issues in the interior, in the rail belt, and then in Southeast. But clearly here in Southeast, it's interties and hydros and other energy generation. Locally, it's going to be funding requests coming from City Hall for Blue Lake, and trying to deal with, and I've asked the Assembly, and I think they have, and the Administrator, and I think they have agreed to go ahead and ask for debt forgiveness on Green Lake. So I've got another tool in the toolkit to play at the table. It would have been easier, of course, to, just as a point of clarification, it'd been easier, of course, to have, from my perspective, a delay in the issuance of the contract for Blue Lake for me to line up the appropriations from the state, but that is a different decision path that I'm on than the Assembly. The Assembly has to be on a decision path of what they think benefits the community, and the financing of it is just one piece of the puzzle. So although it makes my job a little more challenging, I'm sure it was the right decision to make, because they have a lot more, or they have better access to the data and more data than I have to make that decision. So I'll be pursuing that appropriation, and it's probably going to take more than 1 year. And I would like to see our electrical rates held as close to constant as all possible, because we have to regionally be able to compete. On the transportation side, we're going to be pushing again, or I'm going to be pushing again, for more funding for the Marine Highway. We've got about maybe 1.25 ferries as far as cash set aside already for the purchase of replacements of our original ferries. We need another $50 million this year, another $50 million next year, and then we should have enough funds to go forward with two Alaska-class ferries. The other arenas that we get into, depending on, I guess, the requests that come out of the Assembly, and I'll be looking at the request and the positions of all of the communities within the Senate district, and there'll be a lot of synergies within it. So the Assembly will be dictating, or the council of each community, kind of what the community goals are, and we'll try to deliver those as much as we can.
Thank you. Your next question is regarding redistricting. With redistricting, Southeast will have less representation than before. How would you ensure that we are fairly represented at the state level?
Well, I think that's one of the key decisions that the people in the district are going to make, is who they're going to elect to represent them as senator. And clearly, I play, in my opinion, a much more aggressive internal game in Juneau than my competitor. have positioned myself in a more influential position and have delivered a lot more material substance to the district and the region and the state than my competitor. So the first thing, again, is to get elected. After that, we continue to get outnumbered out of the rail belt. We used to have, years ago, we used to have a senator out of Juneau, one out of Ketchikan, one out of Sitka, one out of Petersburg and Wrangell. And now we're down to two for the entire southeast. And 10 years from now, we're probably going to lose, our district will get larger. Maybe it'll go all the way up to Cordova or something, unless we get some population issues turned around. So it's important to get in the best position you can internally within the legislature, obviously being in the majority and then in key committees and then in leadership, and at a point where it's difficult for some of my colleagues when they're going to put forth an agenda that's detrimental to Southeast to get around me.
Okay, the next one is oil production. What could the state of Alaska do to increase oil production?
Well, I figured that question would come up, and then obviously I got the questions last night. So I think what I'd like to do is parse the question to try to give it some clarity to the public. There's existing leases that go back to the beginning when we opened up the basin, and then those areas are unitized and they're pumping oil and everything, generally speaking, is on a fairly even keel. There's areas outside of the existing fields that we have that are more problematic with our tax structure. But if I break it down and we just look at the existing fields and think of it as Prudhoe Bay, Kaparik, Alpine, all the major areas that you've heard over the years, there's several bottlenecks that are challenges that we have. There's the processing units. When you take the oil out of the ground, you've got to run it through a processing unit, strip out the natural gas, strip out the water, get the oil out, ship the oil down the pipeline. And I'm going to try to keep things fairly generic and straightforward because there'll be people from our community that are listening that, you know, have different levels of sophistication in this subject matter, and I want the general public to follow the conversations. So when you first open up an oil field, you're constrained by oil. You've got a lot of oil coming up out of the ground, not a lot of gas, not a lot of water. And as you pump more oil out, then you increase your ratio of gas to oil or water to oil. Prudhoe Bay is gas constrained. Kaparik is water constrained. If we change the tax structure and we didn't change the processing units, you wouldn't get any more oil out of the ground and down the pipeline than you are today. Because you can't, the processing facilities, there's 9 of them, all but one of them are running out of maximum capacity. So you've got to de-bottleneck the processing facilities. Regulations is another area. We've got problems internally with our regulatory environment within the state, and particularly dealing with the federal government. So there's the regulatory arena that you've got to try to deal with. The permitting process. From the state level, last year the Department of Natural Resources Commissioner came in and said he's 25 permits behind. That means permits stacked up on people's desks that aren't moving. It's plugged up. So that went over like a lead balloon. Like, where was the previous commissioners and why wasn't the legislature notified? And we don't want to hear about the whining. We want the issue resolved, so bring us the solution. If it's bringing in independent folks to work on these permits to get them moving, increase your staff base, change your budget around, whatever it takes, but get those 2,600, 2,500 permits off the desk and moving. And to the credit of the Commissioner Sullivan, he's been doing that. And we'll get a report this January from him on his status. I find it appalling that you can have an organization so critical, DNR, to the state of Alaska, which, you know, is governing our oil basin, which is 90-95% of our revenue, and they're plugged up. I think it's ridiculous. So we're working on that, and I wasn't the only one that found it appalling. Permit processing. Then after that, if I could just mention the processing, the current production, and I don't want to get this halfway, more than halfway on the spot, because I can shoot it on the fly and get it pretty close. Just to give you a rough idea, and I'm going to talk in billions, this is for FY13. This is current production, FY13, targeted to end June 30th. We're shooting at a price of $110 a barrel. Oil's about 107, 108 right now. We're shooting for a volume of 540,000 barrels a day, and we're within reason of that. That means the gross value for this fiscal year on existing production is $21.7 billion. The royalties are a little over 2.1. That comes off the top. And just remember, just round it off, you start with 22 and you take 2 away. I graduated from Sitka High School. I can do this math, I can assure you. Okay? The downstream cost, which is put it in the pipeline, put it on a freighter or a tanker, ship it to Cherry Point, sell it, $1.5 billion. That's what it costs. Upstream, get it out of the ground. That means go, you know, drill your wells, run through your processing facilities, pay your property tax, do your capital investments, all that stuff, $6 billion. That's $7.4 billion to get it out of the ground, get it sold. That gives you a pile of cash on your table of $11.3 billion. So when the industry stands before the public and says that their basin is not profitable, I would suggest you question their numbers. $11 billion after costs, net profit to be split. There's three participants at the table to be split between. There's the industry, which is basically Exxon, BP, and Conoco. There's the state of Alaska, and there's the federal government. So there's three of us, the industry, the state, and the feds. The feds are like the third man out, or odd man out. They have their corporate tax structure that's fairly inflexible. We know what ConocoPhillips tax rate is because they disclose it in their filings for the Securities and Exchange Commission. We don't know and have been refused the information from Exxon and BP on what their tax consequences are in Alaska. We don't know that. So we have to assume then, or we assume, that it's at the highest rate, even though we question that. So anyway, that's the current production field, and there lies one of the basic discussions in Juneau is the current production. If it's $11.3 billion laying on the table, it's profitable. Exxon staff there in front of the Finance Committee testified that these existing fields are profitable. Regardless of the tax change, we're going to do infield drilling because it's profitable. That point should not be lost. The question is when we move out of, the difficulty is when we move out of the existing fields, the existing units, and we have to build infrastructure to get to them, our tax structure doesn't work. It doesn't meet the industry's hurdle rates as calculated by them and as calculated by our consultants. So there's problems with our tax structure when we move outside of Prudhoe-Aoka Park. And by the way, Prudhoe is where the oil is. But nonetheless, there is some smaller quantities that we don't want to ignore outside of Prudhoe-Aoka Park and stuff. So we've got a problem out there. We also have a problem with our tax structure when we have high oil prices, substantially north of $100. Below, the governor thinks, and he's been quoted as 80 and below, we're fine. A lot of my colleagues, including myself, think it's closer to $100 a barrel and below refined. North of 100, we get into the debate. Clearly at $150, $140 a barrel, it's very difficult, or more difficult, to substantiate the position that our tax structure shouldn't be altered. And at $200 a barrel, I don't see how anybody could stand before the public and say that our tax structure is messed up, because we would be, in fact, paying 100% the way the credits work. And a credit is where the industry will say pay $100 million for development capital expense. The state will return $20 million of it right away, a 20% capital credit, and allow them to fully expense the $100 million
in that year and depreciate it out over whatever the IRS allows the normal depreciation schedule. So it's huge. And the mathematics of how that works is we end up, the state and the federal government ends up paying 100% of the capital costs when we're pushing out $200 a barrel, which is about double where we are today. So that doesn't work for the state. The other thing that doesn't work for the state, currently, we have no severance tax on gas. It's negative, drives our oil price down, and it's costing us $100 to $150 million a year. So our gas tax is not zero, it's not positive, it's negative. It's net negative. So that doesn't work for the state. So when you take a look at the heavy credits that the state offers, and they go from 20 up to 40 depending on what you're doing, and you look at the gas tax structure, our tax ACES needs to go to the table and get some adjustments. And we get into a whole internal discussion when we look at how to do that. Do you go in and surgically change what's broken, or do you just do a across-the-board reduction in the tax rate like the governor proposed? And our consultants have flat-out told us we'd be moving too much cash, and it's not warranted. And it's pretty easy to do the math, because I just did it here 3 minutes ago for you. So we've got to work that issue out, how to do that. But clearly, outside of the existing fields, we have a problem. And we need to get the tax structure adjusted for that. But it's a dangerous game because once you move it, you can't just go back the next year and change it. So you need to be more deliberate and deliberative in your process and what you're doing. So in a nutshell, that's kind of the gas in a and oil in a quick sound bite. We have, and while I'm on that discussion, let me and I've got kind of a cough, and I apologize for that from, I know, traveling around a lot the last couple months, but let me just give you some of the issues that we've dealt with as we try to sort out this issue, because we've had, even in this room, at that podium, we had the Commissioner of Revenue saying that the tax rate's 90%. The tax rate isn't 90%. Nobody pays 90%. Nobody's ever paid 90%. And they certainly didn't say that in the Finance Committee, because they would have been ridiculed and ran out of the room. They can get away with it in public, but they can't get away with it at the finance table. There was a Fast Enterprise did a study, a review of our internal tax software and processes within the revenue and Department of Natural Resources, and found it dysfunctional to the point where they couldn't assimilate the data and answer our questions, which they couldn't. We had asked them questions and didn't have the ability. That cost the state about $37.5 million in an appropriation that we did, it was a year ago, April, to remedy that, and it's going to take another probably 3-4 years to get that remedy. So the Department of Revenue can't answer the questions that are deliberately asked to them. They don't have the ability to sort through their data. So we're trying to fix that. That appropriation, by the way, was put in by the Senate Finance Committee in the Capitol budget. The labor issue that you've heard about, the bunkhouses are full, they're hot berthing, you can't get more employees on the slope unless you build more bunkhouses. That's just a fact. We went out and had a study done by McDowell Group to actually answer that question. And, you know, because we continually heard that employment was dropping, everything was going down the drain. There's problems possibly with what they're doing. They're doing a lot more maintenance than some of the exploration and development issues and stuff that we'd like to have done. But the fact of the matter is they're basically full employment of around 12,000 people.
I'm going to give you your red flag.
Okay, I got 3 more to go. Okay. Processing facilities, I've already mentioned. Production levels of TAPS. TAPS was going to shut down at 350,000 barrels. Not true. That was a flow study. Internal documents by BP expected it to flow out to 150,000 barrels to 100,000 barrels a day. Last 2065. Under current economic assumptions, economically viable oil that can be produced today with today's technology, 2065. Pipeline's not going to get shut down 6 years from now. just, some of this stuff is just flat misleading information. I covered the marginal tax rate. Comparison universe, I got it on the map back there. We'll see that we're not the highest in the world, anywhere close. And the reserves and oil location is Brutto and Kuparik. And there you've got hydrocarbons. They'll be pumping out of Brutto probably decades. They should be in Brutto and Kuparik for another 80 to 100 years. That's how much volume is there. They thought there was 16 billion when they opened it up. They took out 9. They think there's 7 left. Again, you know, a graduate from Sitka High School. You start with 16, you take 9, you have 7 left. Something's wrong with the starting number. There's a lot of oil left, and that doesn't count heavy oil, doesn't count shale oil. North Dakota has about 350 feet of pay grade shale. We have 1,000. And maybe not all of it's going to be pay grade, but I think our sweetest pay grade is 400 to 500. That's huge if we can get to it with. You know, North Dakota, you've got private ownership, so you can build a land or a road every square mile. We've got some issues up north, but we can't do that. But there's a lot of hydrocarbons. You want to go to the next one, and then we'll just open this back up for questions later, and I can try to answer.
That sounds good. So we have two more pre-written questions, and then we will start taking questions that have been passed forward. So if you have ones written down that you haven't passed forward, we'll be coming around and collecting those. And we have quite a few here, so we'll do our best to get through as many of them as we can. The next question that we have for you is, how do you propose to fund regional energy projects in a way that keeps rates reasonable for the consumer?
There's four letters, or four words and a number. Equity financed, at least 50%. That's the only way you do it. You got to take cash. Blue Lake, we're targeting 50% from the state. We were hoping 25% from the state, 25% from the feds, and 50% from City Hall, but the feds have their problems. So it becomes 50% to the state. I think 50% is going to be too low. That was a dart thrown in the wall when we started this process a few years ago. And if you're going to stabilize rates at 12 or 13 cents, it's probably going to take more than that. So we'll see how that goes, and I've got to sit down with Jay Sweeney, the finance guy at City Hall, and take a look at his projections out forward and the rates and see how much it would actually take to drive that rate down and control it more. But it's all about cash. You can't do it with debt, and you got to build hydro. You got to have electricity, so that's the easiest way to answer that question.
Thank you. The last one that we have pre-written for you is about the Alaska Marine Highway, and I know you touched on this a little bit, so I'll go ahead and ask the question now. Lay out your thoughts on the future of the Alaska Marine Highway system in Southeast Alaska and how to ensure reliable service to Sitka.
Build new ships and keep the boys up north from stripping the cash out of the Marine Highway system like they did several years ago. When I became chairman of the finance committee, the Marine Highway was virtually broke. So now we've got ample cash reserves in the Marine Highway. We've got their fuel bill or their fuel consumption tied to our oil price. So if oil goes up, their fuel budget portion automatically increases. We make it out of the oil we sell, so it's a net wash. And then we put away $50 million last year. I think we're probably $170 million total in cash over the last several years for two new ferries, and we need another 100 to go. And then fighting the schedule, and it's an uphill battle for Sitka. There's no way about it. It's just difficult because it's the ridership and the location of the town. We can't change the location. And we have difficulty with the ridership. But I'll say one thing that's been very helpful is when the community came out and marketed and pushed and encouraged the citizens to ride the fast ferry. It was a big help. And hopefully the community will continue to do that.